Vectis Radio, FM 104.6, the island's local station.
Hello, I'm Joan Ellis and welcome back to Island, a two-part series in which, without sounding too much like a question on my geography O-level paper, I attempt to compare and contrast the similarities and differences between our very own Isle of Wight and two very different islands off the coast of Australia, Kangaroo Island and Heron Island on the Great Barrier Reef. In this, the second in the series, I discover there's more to Kangaroo Island than kangaroos. When I first moved from London to the island 10 years ago, I underestimated how hard it would be to adjust, to make friends and fit in. I'd always loved the island. With its beautiful beaches and bucolic countryside, it was my heaven on earth. Making the place my home really would be living the dream, wouldn't it? Within weeks, I was lonely and found myself pounding the shoreline, not knowing what else to do. What should have been an enjoyable pursuit became an obsession as I combed the beach for treasure. Shells, driftwood, rope, captain's knots and brightly coloured buoys, all the raw materials I needed to make work that evoked the spirit of the sea. I presented them at the Isle of Wight Open Studio, opening up my cottage as a makeshift gallery for the weekend. I'm convinced people really came to see inside the 17th century thatched house and felt obliged to buy the work, something to hang in their townhouse bathroom, a salty reminder of being beside the seaside. Like the Isle of Wight, Kangaroo Island offers up shoreline treasures in abundance, but with added specialities. Delicate seahorse skeletons, perfectly symmetrical sea anemones, and the discarded plumage of foppish birds. One artist on Kangaroo Island makes the most of this raw material, Jennifer Woodhouse. I'm invited to her basement studio and immediately enter a world of wonder. A glove, a skeletal wing, a whiff of the sea. Marvellously macabre, Jennifer sheds light on the darkest corners of the imagination. I instantly fall in love with her work. It is at once delightful and robust, creating life and death with the deftest of strokes. Like her work, Jennifer is delicate and exact, tiny, almost bird-like herself. She sees beauty and potential where most would see decay, seizing upon the skull of a bird or a length of tangled seaweed to weave her magic. She's ethereal. Her connection to these objects is tangible. These are not things to be drawn, painted, depicted. They are hers to breathe new life into. She doesn't keep a certain brand of champagne in a pretty cabinet, but she does display a snakeskin. I find it beautiful but unnerving. Jen has no such reservations, reveling in her finds. Although she deals in the dark side, when I speak to her, I see nothing but light. Her job is to convey the beauty of life even after death. Listen to what she has to say.
Vectis Radio, FM 104.6, Isle of Wight's community station.
I'm here now with Jennifer Woodhouse, artist. Welcome, Jennifer.
Thank you.
And how long have you lived on Kangaroo Island?
Nearly 7 years now.
And what's the best thing about it for you?
I think it's the natural environment, the ocean for sure, and the peace and quiet.
And having looked at your beautiful work, that inspires and informs your work, doesn't it?
Very much so, very much so.
And what are you currently working on?
I'm currently working on a bird, which I have just started to draw out. Having finished a still life with shells that you have seen. So my latest work will be a bird.
And you've got all manner of things in your studio that you were kind enough to show me. You've got a number of seahorse skeletons, and they're exquisite, and there's a few of them intact. Absolutely beautiful. Now, These aren't the sort of things we'd find on the Isle of Wight, so you're incredibly lucky to have... And what are these little purple, are they anemones?
Sea urchins,
yes. Yeah, they're beautiful. So you've got so much rich pickings, haven't you?
Inspiration, yeah. Absolutely, yes. And it's all on the doorstep,
indeed.
Which is fabulous, yes.
And in your display cabinet here, you've got a snake skin. Where did you get that from?
At the local wildlife park.
As you do. So did you just pick that up or did they give it to
no,
you?
No, I saw several of them and asked them and they kind of let me have that. Okay. So I can use that in a reference.
Yes.
At some stage, yeah.
And one of the favourite pieces of work that I had my eye on downstairs was something really beautiful that you're setting up. You've got a glove, looks like a 1950s, 1960s satin glove, and a marble, and a couple of moths. And you describe that as the macabre with the beautiful.
Yeah,
that?
Beautiful macabre. I don't know where it comes from, but it's my window dressing days, wanting to put things together and display things. And I just take all sorts of things that inspire me or resonate with me, and for some reason a glove and a moth and a marble and a claw, that sort of thing. Something a little bit different.
Yes, it's lovely. And you explained to me the process that you're going to work, so that's actually going to form two pieces, isn't it?
Yes, it'll at the moment not sure exactly how it will turn out, but yes, it will be a drawing. It will definitely be a drawing, probably on film, drafting film, colour pencil.
You say drafting film, can you just explain what that is?
Yes, it literally is drafting film, similar to tracing paper, but smoother and thicker, so you get a nice smooth texture to it. It's very nice to work with.
Are there certain materials that you can use with drafting film?
You can use quite a lot of different mediums. I choose to use coloured pencil, but I think you can use ink and paints and that. I haven't tried that myself.
Looking at your work, there's so much fine detail in it. I would think it does take a lot of patience.
It does. A lot of patience, which I didn't have when I was young, but being a bit older now, I do. And a keen observation, to be quite honest. And that is part of the process for me that's so enjoyable, being able to actually see the intricacies and the colour within a certain subject. And you wouldn't see that if you weren't sitting quietly.
Yeah, and do you... Do you think that's a lesson that your work has taught you, you know, that you've learned through the art, is to be more patient?
Yes, and that can spill out into life in general. And yes, the observation, observing different things.
So how long would, I know there's no such thing as an average piece of work, but how long do you generally, how long is the longest you've spent on a piece?
I would think the longest would probably be a few months, but that would be working on it for 3 or 4 or 5 hours intermittently.
And do you work on one piece exclusively, or do you have a few on the go at the same time?
No, I tend to have one that I'm actually working on and one that I'm trying to figure out, just to give myself a break from the intense work.
And you were talking to me earlier when you were showing me around your gallery here in your home, how you sell your work and how you interact with your customers, which is quite unusual.
Yes, I find that when you've done a piece of work, there's a lot of yourself there, and to just let it go and not know where it's gone is sort of a little disturbing sometimes. To meet the person that's buying it is lovely, because then you can interact, tell them the inspiration behind it. It's just a more personal thing, and people like to meet the artist.
Yeah, and presumably you have loyal customers.
Yes, you do. You have people who have a following and waiting to see what happens next, which is rather nice, yes.
And what is going to happen next?
I have several things on the go, one of which you saw, the lady with the folded back paper.
Yes, that is beautiful.
Yes, and a shell. That's still in my mind at the moment, but I've just finished a piece, so I'm kind of open.
And you were telling me, I think it was the glove piece, with the glove and the marble and the moth, that you were really looking forward to working on.
Oh, yes.
Very excited. So do you sometimes sort of artificially keep that back so that you've got something to look forward to?
Sometimes there's always, yes, it's like having a present and you're not going to open it. But sometimes I've got so much going on, I don't know where to start. But that one in particular we're talking about, yes, I'm looking forward to that. That's especially for myself.
And do you work on commissions for people?
I do. Commissions can be confining in some respects. Yes, I do. I have done. But I do prefer it, to be quite honest, just to do a piece, because it comes from the heart then.
And a commission, if they said, okay, Jennifer, do what you will, you know, we'll give you a blank sheet, and would that encourage you?
Yes.
And what about, because, you know, you have a beautiful home and you have all your fabulous artwork here, what about day-to-day life? I mean, just things like the rest of us have to cope with, like housework. Do you find time for that?
No, I don't like housework. But I love my veggie patch. I've got a lovely veggie patch. And gardening. But very art orientated.
Yes.
And reading. But yes, art takes up most of my life, really.
The flowers, do they feature in your work as well?
I have done flowers, yes. I do tend to do more of the things I've shown you. But I have done flowers in the past, yes.
Yeah. Mm. Well, it's been an absolute joy to meet you, Jennifer. Do you want to just tell people where they can see your work online?
Yes, I have a website, which is www.jenniferwoodhouseartist.com, and I'm also on Instagram.
Well, thank you very much for your time. It's been a pleasure.
It's been lovely having you. Nice to meet you. Thank you.
This is Vectis Radio, FM 104.6.
The Isle of Wight is home to many an artist. It was ever thus, from Julia Margaret Cameron pioneering her groundbreaking photographic techniques at Dimbola Lodge Freshwater, to the island inspiring the likes of Dickens, Tennyson and Keats to pen some of their best work. Today there is a thriving art community right across the island, from Freshwater Bay to Ryde, with Key Arts in Newport at the heart. There's a wealth of talent here, from artists to players, playwrights and poets, all showcasing their work at galleries, open studios, theatres and numerous spoken word events. The island even has its very own literary festival in Cowes, and Ventnor plays host to our outstanding Fringe Festival every year. Walking through Newport's Key Arts shop, I see the breadth of skill and talent on offer. Exquisite handmade jewellery, covetable pottery and paintings. The place is an Aladdin's cave of one-off pieces. The place is a hub for artists, putting on free film shows, music and spoken word events, as well as being the perfect workshop and gallery space. Islands are inspiring places, no doubt about it. There's something in the air that ignites creativity. Stay for long enough and you will write that book, paint that picture, pen that poem. Hallelujah. Hear what artist Donna Jones, MPE, has to say about making work here on the Isle of Wight.
Vectis Radio, FM 104.6, bringing the island's community together.
Hello, and I'm here talking to Donna Jones, and you're an island artist, aren't you, Donna? I know you hail from up north.
I do.
But you've made your home here in Ryde. And tell me, what's your inspiration for your work?
Do you know what, Joan? It was a tin of brand new colouring pencils when I was a child. That's the inspiration.
And how old would you have been?
Oof, I would say from five upwards, really, because obviously at Christmas and birthdays, that's what we got. You know, I always wanted paper and art and things like that, and I was at the stage of copying. And I always remember the excitement of opening a new tin of pencil crayons, you know, that ran from white through to yellow, ochre, orange, vermilion, all the way through to the purple and the black. It was just so exciting for me. And the other one was Disney, the Disney films.
Which one in particular?
For me, it would be Snow White and Bambi. In terms of the colours, I just absolutely adored them. You know, my mum used to take us there during the holidays with an apple. You know, we'd sit there and with an apple and a piece of cake or something. And I was just, that from that being very young I soaked up colour. Absolutely soaked up colour.
Because a lot of your work is very vibrant, isn't it?
It is, yeah. I mean, the funny thing is, mum always brought us up you know, the house was always about having autumn colours, you know, and she had the Glowbacks Minster carpet, and it was always browns and fawns and mustards and those kind of greens. There was never any reds, yellows, oranges, vibrant colours.
Well, they talk about colours popping now, don't they? I think
yes.
That's the thing in interior design.
It was very subdued.
Yes.
You know, the walls would be hints of, you know, green or a hint of white or a hint of whatever, you know, but nothing that actually smacked you in the face. Other than what I would say as well was, I remember when we used to have lino in the house, because that was the poor man's carpet, wasn't it,
yes,
at the time? And there was sort of a, mum had a green, the boys had a blue, and I had a yellow. And so I remember that as well. But I also remember the clothes that she used to make for me. She used to make my clothes, and it would be kilts in winter, and then it would be the summer dresses. So I got the colour as well through her making me the flowery, lovely, bright yellow kind of summer
and
dresses.
And did you pick that fabric or did Mum?
Oh, no. Mum picked it. But, you know, that and the white socks or the whatever. And it was like, so at that point, colour was coming into the way that I was starting to look at it.
And was art something you pursued through school?
Yes. Yeah, I absolutely loved it. It was always colouring books. I went mad for a spirograph. It drove me mad after 10 minutes because the pins kept popping out, but I would constantly copy things, and my uncle, bless him, he's not here now, has still got a painting drawing that I did of Goofy, Mickey Mouse and Donald Duck when I was about maybe 10 in a frame.
Lovely. So what would have been your first original artwork?
For myself?
Yeah, that you created.
For myself. Now, this is an interesting one because at school, obviously, the first teacher that we had, it was a very elderly guy, but my gosh, was he an amazing artist. I've still got some of the things that he gave to me when he retired. He always seemed very old, though. He was one of those guys with the moustache and he smoked a pipe and the, you know, tweed jacket. So I was very much into his art, although his teaching was horrendous. It was like we got a bit of scrap paper. And it was like, draw a market stall, draw a horse. I couldn't do it, useless. And then he retired and we got this new artist. And she was obviously really into modern women's art. So it would be, I'm trying to think now, some of the Mexican artists, Frida Kahlo and people like that, you know. So she was introducing us to that when I was doing my, at the time, O-levels. And I always remember what she did was she gave us a flower. And she gave us a piece of card with a little square cut out in the middle of the card and got us to put it over the flower. So we only painted the bit that we could see, but we made it massive. So in that sense, for me, that was an original piece of art.
I see.
Yeah.
I see.
But then I did A-level. So we had to look at doing things differently in terms of sculptures and looking at things differently and all that sort of stuff. So I would say, I mean, even when I was at, you know, college doing teacher training and art was one of my subjects, it was about using it to teach. But I also did posters for the drama groups, so I would advertise their next events and I'd come up with ideas of how to do that. Now, it was never screen printing or anything like that. It was every piece was original, and every time I did them, somebody nicked them.
Oh no.
But that, isn't that nice as well?
Well, yeah,
the fact that they wanted, like that. Yeah, the fact that they wanted my artwork. So I didn't then really have time, once I'd qualified and started teaching and all the rest of it, to develop my art. So I did it, believe it or not, there was a women's centre that opened up in Sheffield and they wanted some artwork on the walls, and they'd heard, apparently somebody had told them that I could do art, and they came to see me, and I was amazed that they wanted my artwork, you know, and that's what happened, and started selling it at that point. So, of course, me being me, the adrenaline's flowing and I'm off. I'm on a roll, you know, I can't stop. And then I did the art markets. So my thing was always about every piece of artwork that I do is an original.
Yeah.
I might do it six times, but everyone is obviously original. So I never took prints.
And
that's the way that I developed it, as well as being inspired by key artists as well, which, you know, I can talk about if you want.
Yeah. So what... Once you've arrived here on the island, where's your inspiration now? What is it about being here, perhaps, that informs your work?
Okay, this is an unusual one. When I came to the island, obviously I wanted to join and be part of the art on the island, because I knew it was an island that encouraged and attracted people that are artists, both in terms of spoken word, music, etc. And I joined the Ride Art Collective, which was really, it was fabulous for me because it introduced me to artists and to events and to exhibitions and things like that, and I exhibited. But I'm going to say I played safe with my art. So it was boat scenes, it was boat sculptures, it was flowers, it was things that I felt were very, very safe. The other side of the coin is I've got artwork that I would say is very raw, very challenging, and to be honest, the island wouldn't display it, wouldn't exhibit it. And one of the main things was around beauty and disease. Now, usually those two things are kept very separate. I wanted to bring them together because obviously as people get older, you know, we get diseases. The beauty magazines, the hairdressing magazines, the model magazines, you never see that kind of thing together. And the only way that I could find out about diseases was to buy a medical book. And so I painted these very evocative, beautiful faces, men and women, and then I added the diseases to them. And there was an exhibition, I think you came to it, you and Dougie, in at Gasp in Southsea, and that's the first time that that whole series had been exhibited. So for me now, I'm looking outside of that, outside of the box, and there's a wonderful woman on the island called Jo Corey, who her husband is a professor of art, and they have developed their house into the potential for an art gallery. So Joe's talking to me about being able to exhibit the more challenging of my artwork, which is what's inspiring me at the minute.
And that's in Ventnor, isn't it?
It is in Ventnor, yeah.
Yeah. So when you work, when you create, is the space in which you make your art, is that important to you?
Yes. I have to know where everything is. It looks like creative chaos to anybody else, but for me it's about, I know, because obviously what I do as well is I don't just paint, I use broken glass, I use things that I find on the beach, I use wood, I use clay. I mean, I've been doing a whole series around antiquity and civilization at risk, which is based on the destruction of, you know, incredible things, 3,000 years old, Palmyra, and in, you know, in the Middle East, and ISIS are destroying a lot of stuff, which we will never, ever get back. So what I'm doing at the moment is I'm trying to find material, natural material, broken pottery, handmade pottery, that I'm creating pieces of artwork that look as though they've come from the past. They're archaeological digs.
Just to confuse those people that come after.
Yes, absolutely. And so what I'm doing is I'm making these pieces of artwork that actually from first sight look very, very old, because everything's original in there. And I've made my own topography, hieroglyphics, and so it looks as though this found piece of paper or this found piece of pottery or slate or clay is very, very old, but in fact it's not, it's very modern. But what I'm trying to do is to get people to reflect on things that we will never get back.
That's very interesting, isn't it, because it's almost, this reflects the animal kingdom, isn't it, and that extinction being forever.
Yes.
And I think that's quite a concept for people, yes, to get their heads around, isn't it, that once it's gone,
it's gone. And that's the worrying thing. We never, I mean, obviously human life is most important, as we know. But, you know, this is what I'm doing. And again, the, you know, the sort of poems in bottles that have been given out to people and being buried.
Oh, all over the island?
Malta, Hungary, Spain, wherever people are going on holiday, I'm hoping Australia eventually, are taking the bottles with them and burying them in the hope that maybe in 50 to 100 years' time, they get found.
Well, we're certainly burying one here on the island. Fabulous. And I think you've got other friends.
Yes, I think there's 50 plus bottles gone so far.
Brilliant.
Amazing. I mean, how excited would you be to find something like that in 50 years' time?
It's just, I think that was always a dream, that I'd pick up a message in a bottle sitting on one of the island beaches, but never have. Have you?
No, never. Obviously, you know, and one of the things that I've been doing with that is I've been working with lead. I had some spare lead from a roof in Sheffield, and so what I did was I started to put
not been
poems
on the rob again, Donna, have you?
Not quite. I'm always on the lookout. Anyway, so I'm writing my poems in this lead, and then I went and bought one of those stamp sets, A to Z stamp sets. So I'm stamping my poetry into these sheets of lead, not wearing gloves, of course, me being stupid, and then I'm rolling them really tight. And Morag, an artist potter on the island, has made me a cylindrical pot out of ceramic. It's beautiful. And so it's like the Dead Sea Scrolls. So we've put my poem is in there now, and it is sealed. And so I've been doing that with big pots that I've been finding, or buying cheap second-hand garden pots and putting pieces of artwork in them. And then obviously the idea is that at some point, you know, as presents, or as they get buried, or they, I don't know, they're there, and there's things in them from the past because they're all dated.
And so going, what's next for Donna Jones artist? What?
Do you know what? It's very difficult to say. I have to allow the muses to come into my brain and suddenly give me another idea. The more I immerse myself in it, the more ideas actually come. So at this moment in time, I'm still working on finding things on the beach that are original, as I say, original pieces of artwork, pottery, etc. Maybe one of the things that I've thought about is a book. Making a book with all these kind of things in it, yeah? So that the inner and the outer side will be old roof tiles.
Oh, lovely.
So that will be the casing of, and I actually do that writing as well, the hieroglyphics, and I gave one away yesterday, on old tiles, roof tiles, and I write on them with white pen. So I either write poems that people can read, or I write the hieroglyphic stuff, and they'll say to me, what's this about? You know, what's that? What does it say? And I say, it says whatever you want it to say.
Uh-huh.
So write down and tell me what you think that says. So it allows people to have their own interpretation as well.
Mm. And that's very art, isn't it? You know, particularly abstract art people. You know, other artists have said to me, it's whatever you want it to mean.
Yeah.
It's not about what I saw. It's about what you see.
I like the idea of engagement as well. Mm. In terms of community engagement, so that's one route that can happen, and obviously you know, I love resourcing things that I find on the island, so I'm in skips all the time, you know, anything that I find. I've seen some nice bits in your garden that I might end up taking to incorporate. So I'm looking at things that are both three-dimensional. I'm looking at obviously the normal, you know, A-size flat kind of card and canvas and all that sort of thing. But again, it's about, for me, whatever comes in that little brain of mine.
And so living on the island, you'd say that is part of your inspiration?
It is, but I also am part of Aspects Gallery in Portsmouth, because as a member of them, they are semi-professional artists that want to take it to the next stage. So I also have a tutorial with Jonathan, which actually is fantastic, because he'll challenge me and he'll look at things and say, have you thought about doing that? Because he obviously, his knowledge of art history and modern day art is absolutely amazing. And every so often we'll do presentations to the rest of the group, so I get feedback from them.
Fantastic. So we can expect lots more from Donna Jones.
Of course.
Brilliant. Thank you very much for your time, Donna.
We are your Vectis Radio, FM 104.6.
When it comes to action on Australia's Kangaroo Island, Andrew Neighbour's Marine Adventures is a dream come true. I've always wanted to swim with dolphins in the wild. Andrew promises to take me to the dolphins' lounge room, where they are safe, where they chill out. The weather's closing in. I board the boat and don a sou'wester, ducking my head and hiding behind the seat in front to avoid the worst of the crashing waves and hailstones. Yet within 10 minutes, as promised, we are in the shallows. Tranquil turquoise waters mottled by sunlight that would be the envy of the Caribbean. I put on a shorty wetsuit, mask and snorkel and slip quietly into the water. Make like a dolphin, Andrew tells me. Make a noise. Go on. I squeak, doing my best to sound like Flipper. It works. Within minutes, I'm surrounded. One wants to play, and I swirl about laughing, gurgling, semi-choking on brine. But I don't care. This is heaven.
Vectis Radio, FM 104.6, Isle of Wight's community station.
Hello, Andrew.
How are you?
I'm great. Now, you may have guessed from Andrew's accent, we're not actually on the Isle of Wight. We're on Kangaroo Island, just south of Australia. And you run a very exciting marine adventure here, don't you?
Yeah, we run a truly wild swim with the dolphins. So we get people out and get amongst the dolphins and some coastal scenery and do a few thrills on the boat and and mix it up a bit. Yeah, it's good.
And how long have you been doing it for, Andrew?
Oh, we've been doing this for about 12 years. Yeah, so it's pretty good.
And what's the most exciting thing that's happened when you've been out at sea with a group of people?
I think we do a lot of Make-A-Wish foundations with terminally ill people. They'll come out and they'll swim with the dolphins as one of those things that they like to tick off, and there's been some pretty memorable moments there, yeah.
That must be incredible.
Oh, it's fantastic. And like the dolphins are just so smart, like they're just so intelligent. But they're amazing animals.
And today, I mean, we had such fun. I mean, the weather didn't look that promising, but you took us to somewhere really beautiful. Where was that?
Yeah, we went over to North Cape. And as I said, like getting there is going to be the drama, but as long as we can get there, we'll be all right. But yeah, we ended up with about 35 dolphins. So you guys are in swimming wildly with about 35 dolphins in like you said, it looks like the Bahamas over there.
It was fantastic. I mean, we just donned the wetsuits, went in, and surrounded by the most incredible, amazing, beautiful creatures that wanted to play, wanted to come up to us and have fun. And that was a dream come true. I mean, a lifetime dream come true. So thank you so much for that.
Yeah, no, it's not a problem. That's what we do. We like to make people smile and happy. But it is a true wild dolphin swim. You know, people say like we've done them before and swam with them in captivity or that type of thing. But this is truly a wild dolphin swim. We're taking you to a dolphin's relaxation area, or what we call a dolphin's lounge room, and put you in the water and away you go, and you're free to swim how you like. Yeah, it's good.
Oh, it's lovely. I just wish it had been a little bit warmer, because I could have stayed in there all day. I'd have said, you know, just come back and pick me up tomorrow, because it was absolute heaven. And what do you get out of it? Because obviously you're out here most days, I imagine.
Yeah, I think the what I get out of it, the most enjoyment, I guess, is just that, you know, that feedback from people when they've been in the water and they've been looking to do this, a special experience like this, you know, like yourself, you know, for a lot of years, and it happens and it works. And a lot of people say, you know, we're going to see dolphins, and I'll say, look, you know, you're paid to go swimming with dolphins, so that's what we're going to do, you know, we guarantee it, which is really good. But it's something different every day.
Well, we certainly hit some interesting weather, didn't we?
Yeah, we got a couple of hail storms today, so that was interesting. Probably around about, I don't know, I reckon one or two of them might have been about 5 degrees.
But you handled that so skillfully. I mean, you just literally dodged around the clouds. It was incredible.
Yeah, and I think that's another part of it is to have your eyes open while you're out there, because, like, you know, as we made that sort of a run for it to come home, but we went around the outside of that, and we sort of missed most of it, but the bit we did get was pretty ordinary, but we managed to get our way through it.
And the real magic coming back was when you were creating the waves and the dolphins were leaping through them.
Yeah, they love that, and that's the only thing that they get. You know, we don't feed them, so when we're finished, we'll make a couple of passes, make some nice big waves, and if they want to jump in on that and do some surfing, which they do like 90% of the time or 95% of the time, they'll always get on those waves, on those pressure waves, and do some surfs and do some antics and some nice high jumps for us, which is good.
So you a native of Kangaroo Island, have you lived here all your life?
Yeah, I'm a fifth generation islander, so yeah, we've been here for a lot of years. Yeah, we've got some ties to the first explorers that got here, so that's good. Yeah.
Wow. So all were sailors?
Yeah, a bit of everything. Yeah, we've been mixed up in a bit of everything. Yeah, fishing, farming, tourism.
And for you, what's the best bit about being on an island, and particularly on this gorgeous Kangaroo Island here?
The best thing about being and living on Kangaroo Island, we travelled years ago, but the best part about being here and living here is you can do whatever you like. You can do whatever you like.
Yeah, I certainly get that impression. It's very easygoing, very fun-loving.
When we started this business, Kangaroo Island Marine Adventures, like, you know, my mate said to me, you're bloody crazy. What do you think you're doing? And I said, well, because I used to be a cray fisherman. And they said, I said to them, I want to do something different. I'm sick of cray fishing. And so I took our model to the authorities, like the national parks and Juna and that, and I said, look, we're going to go take people swimming with dolphins, we're going to do this, we're going to do that, and they said, oh, fair enough, off you go. So that's what came from the authorities, off you go.
Brilliant. And how many can you get on your boat? How many have you had at any one time?
We can carry 20 on this boat. On the other boat we can carry 12. But yeah, it's we basically specialise in dolphins, like wild dolphin swims. That's what we specialise in. That's what we've been doing for, you know, 12 years now. So we're sort of, yeah, that's where we can guarantee it. We're probably one of the only places in Australia where we guarantee a dolphin swim. Yeah.
And what about the shark question?
Yeah, look, there's not a problem here. Like I said, I'm a fifth generation Islander, and where we go swimming with the dolphins, that's another part of the safety side of it, is that we go to where they know it's safe. So we're going to a dolphin's relaxation area, and the reason they've selected these areas where we go and swim with them is because it's safe for them as well. So we're basically following them, you know, and they're saying, like, this is where we're going to swim, so we'll swim with you there as well.
And what's the hairiest moments you've had out on the water?
Probably a run-in with an orca. Yeah, killer whales. That's probably the hairiest.
And how did you handle that?
We didn't actually. We just stood there and watched. We didn't have much choice. This thing was probably 30 foot long and leapt out the water 3 or 4 times. And the last time it leapt out, we could have touched it. It comes straight up the side of the boat. We could have actually touched it with our hands, and it went straight up. And we all sort of looked at it, and it just landed right back on the side of right on the side of the boat and just absolutely drowned us all. And then he just disappeared. Never saw him again.
But he could have gone up underneath the boat and overturned you, couldn't he?
Well, that's what that's what we were thinking, but but it didn't happen. Oh, thank Christ for that. Wow. We have to play another day.
And Kangaroo Island, as the name suggests, I mean, it's full of kangaroos. I mean, they're not leaping out all over the place, although they are at night time apparently, aren't they, because they're nocturnal.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, throughout the day you'll find, where we are here, just up the road in the scrub there, there's roos and all that up in there, but throughout the day they pretty much lay low. Yeah, they just lay low, and you know, if you have a good enough look through the bushes in the daytime, you will see them. But you know, especially in summertime, people say, we didn't see any kangaroos, but you know, they're under the trees in the shade, they're getting out of it, sort of thing. But yeah, like, the best thing to do is a nocturnal tour. Yeah. See them out at night, that's the way to go.
And the koalas just hanging about in the trees, aren't they?
Yeah, they're everywhere. Yeah, they're just, the island's covered with them. Absolutely covered with them, yeah.
Our island's supposed to be covered with red squirrels, but we hardly ever see them, but they are there, so we're very lucky in that respect, but we don't have kangaroos or wallabies, and yeah, it's gorgeous. I've yet to see a possum, but I've seen the little thing like a porcupine. What's that called?
Yeah, porcupine, the spiky little bugger, yeah.
No, not that one, the one with the nose that digs into
the echidna. Yeah, the echidna, yeah. That's our version of the porcupine. Yeah.
So what's the best thing for you about living on an island?
I think it's the freedom. Like I was saying before, you can really pretty much do, you know, you can pretty much do whatever you like. We're at that point where we sort of, when we want to do something, we'll just basically go and do it, you know, like we don't have to stop in traffic, we don't have to do this, we don't have to order this or that. A little bit challenging living on an island, as you guys would probably know, but yeah, it's pretty much all here, and you really can do whatever you like, yeah.
And when we said we were coming out with you today, and we said, oh yeah, we're going out with Andrew. Oh, Andrew, everybody knows Andrew.
Apparently, yeah. Been here for a while. Yeah, but like, we hadn't had fish for a while. So this is just an example. Like the other day, we hadn't had fish for a couple of weeks. And I just decided, well, I'm going to go and get some fish. And that's what you do. If you want some fish, you want some seafood, you just go and get it. So I put the smaller boat in the water and filled up the esky in about probably 10 minutes, I guess. And that was, you know, fish for a week. And it's all free.
Fantastic. How often do you get in with the dolphins now? Because obviously you're captain of the boat. How often do you swim with them?
I'll get in the water generally when I'm by myself. If I'm taking the boat back to Kingscote or from Kingscote to Emu Bay, and it's a really nice day or late in the afternoon, I'll generally call in there and see what they're up to, and that's when I'll get in the water. I'll get in there when I'm by myself. I'll just drop the anchor, slide over the back, and it's unbelievable. It really is. Like, it's almost like you're talking to them.
And what's been the most special moment you've had with a dolphin yourself?
Probably a situation like that where we've had... Well, I've pulled up there on the way home, and I've just gone into the shallows and turned the boat off, dropped the anchor, and the dolphins, there was probably 100 dolphins there, and they've just all swarmed around the boat, and they're just, it's almost like they were saying, come on, get in, come on, there's your chance, sort of thing. But they were all hanging around, and it was, I almost didn't get in. They were so close to the boat, and you could hear their echolocation. You could hear them squeaking away. And, yeah, I just thought, I held right off before I actually got in the water. And then when I got in the water, it was just unbelievable. Yeah, they were all, you know, they were just swimming all over you. Crazy.
Just before we got in, you told us to mate like a dolphin and make squeaky noises. And it seemed to work.
Yeah, well, that's right. Everything to a dolphin, everything in the dolphin's world is all sound. So any type of noise that you can bring in, as long as it's not threatening, they're going to find that quite interesting, and they're going to come and check it out. So we had a family the other day, and the young lad was only, he was only six, actually. He was making this horrible bloody sound on the boat, like this, as you know, young kids might look out every now and then, but it's just a real continuing for probably an hour. And I said, look, just hold off on that sound, and when you get in the water, then you can make that sound again. And he did, and I said, now make that sound as good as you can and as loud as you can with your mouth in the water. And the dolphins just nailed him, absolutely nailed the whole family. Like, they just were going round and round, and then the young lad could see the response that was coming back from the dolphins, so he kept making the squeaky sound. They just got inundated by them.
Well, thank you so much for making one of my lifelong dreams come true. I've just had an absolute ball today. Thank you, Andrew. It's been a pleasure.
No, it's my pleasure.
Thank you.
Your support matters. We operate thanks to the support of local businesses. If you would like to advertise on Vectis Radio, FM 104.6, contact our team today. marketing@vectisradio.fm.
From swimming with dolphins off Kangaroo Island to swimming with sharks, rays and turtles on Heron Island, a world-renowned destination for tourists and researchers to discover the natural wonders of the Great Barrier Reef. It's a conservation area and home to 120,000 birds. The ones that nest and squawk outside my apartment are called noddies, with between 70,000 and 120,000 of them arriving on the island during September and October to breed. Their nests are makeshift affairs, half a dozen leaves slapped over a branch and held together with bird poo and saliva. I see one sporting what looks like a fascinator worn at the Melbourne Cup, a coronet of stalks and black berries. Another has the foliage fashioned into an elaborate overskirt. She tries to fly, but can't, turning her head to peck at the fruit in a vain attempt to free herself. I see these pathetic birds everywhere. But the very same tree, the Pisonia grandis, that provides the leaves from which the noddies make their nests, supplies the sticky seeds that ensnare them. Grounded, the birds cannot find food and perish, eventually providing the nutrients the seeds require to germinate. Such a beautiful island being home to such cruelty doesn't sit well with me. I want to rescue these birds, but their imploring look and feathers glued together, they look pathetic. And there are posters everywhere telling me not to interfere. The Australian government imposes hefty fines for anyone contravening the law. To stand by and do nothing goes against my nature, but I must let Mother Nature take her course. Up to 30,000 mutton birds, I'm not making these names up, really, arrive on the island during September to October to return to their burrows to breed. By day, the adult birds fish offshore. By night, they return to sit by their homes, the couple singing to each other, their bizarre wailing reaffirming their partnership, but sounding more like murder in the undergrowth. Yet birds' songs are strangely life-affirming. If they can hunker down and pledge their troth, there's hope for the rest of us. The egrets strut about on their pin-thin legs, child snatchers of the bird world waiting to rob noddy eggs. I shoo them away and hope no one reports me to the bird police. Heron Island has come a long way from the 1920s, a gruesome chapter in its history, when it was home to a turtle canning factory. There were two attempts to make this enterprise work. I'm glad to say both failed. Sea turtles are great survivors, having evolved over 120 million years. Between October and March, Heron Island is a major nesting home for green and loggerhead turtles, with the hatchlings emerging from December to April. The remarkable grand dams of the ocean use their internal sat-nav to return to the very beach they were born on to lay their own eggs, 120 at a time, laying up to 5 times a year. With only 1 in 1,000 hatchlings surviving, it makes sense to raise the odds. I don't dare hope I'll be lucky enough to witness these expectant mums in action. But Mother Nature has treats aplenty in store.
At high tide, I spot the first one emerging from the water, propelling herself up the beach. Green sea turtles move both front flippers at the same time, creating paired parallel markings in the sand. Loggerheads move one flipper at a time, creating alternating flipper marks with a wavy line running through the centre. If I didn't know better, I'd think quad bikes had run amok on the sand. My girl gets to work, sending up great clouds of sand. Her work takes several hours. The deeper she digs, the slower she gets. It's the equivalent of a pregnant woman having to hand carve the bed she's about to give birth in. I watch as her hole is dug and she uses her back flippers to create a chamber in which to lay her eggs. About half an hour later, her task complete, she goes into a zen-like trance and begins to lay. Having popped out an eye-watering number of eggs, I spot what appears to be a single tear rolling down her cheek. I realise I am crying too. I want to hug her and tell her she's amazing and that she should be so proud of her bouncing ping-pong balls. She blinks, covers the eggs to ensure no air pockets before settling in about camouflaging the nest from predators. Every flick of the sand ends with a sigh. Her job done, she will never get to see her babies. Stoically, she heads back down the beach. But in the time it's taken her to dig the hole, lay her eggs and cover them, the tide has turned, elongating her journey as she negotiates a patch of rocks revealed at low tide. Like a new mum trying to scale Mount Everest, she clambers over, eventually making it into the sea. Her partner is waiting for her. But there's no bouquet of seaweed, a toy koala in the world's well done, love. You must be exhausted. Put your flippers up and relax. No, he only wants one thing. To mate with her again. Sensibly, she waits in the shallows, biding her time until she regains her strength. It's either that or risk being prey to sharks. Mother Nature at her brutal best again. All along the beach, there are turtles at various stages of the birthing process. The strip has turned into a maternity ward. And after all this effort and all this care for precious eggs, it's odd to think that in a few months' time, these very hatchlings will have to fend for themselves. They start life in jeopardy, having to avoid predators as they run down the beach to the ocean. I can see I'll have to return in January, football rattle in hand, to ward off the seagulls who swoop down to feast on the hatchlings. Hardly any wonder any one in a thousand survives. Although I want to increase the odds, this island is always teaching me that nature must take its course. I've always loved turtles, but suddenly I feel an enormous respect for them too. Cumbersome creatures who lumber up the beach alone, laying their eggs by cover of darkness in the hope one or two might defy the odds and make it. To be privileged enough to swim with these magnificent creatures is a dream come true. I love watching them surface for air, their hair, heads like ancient jewels. They are beautiful, and unless you're a jellyfish, benign. Cumbersome on land, but majestic in the ocean, as they appear to half swim, half fly. Keeping a respectful distance, my mood calms. The turtle turns her head, and for a brief moment, we make eye contact. She is conveying wisdom beyond words, and sadly, beyond me. I get the feeling she's seen it all before. Seen it, done it, got the t-shirt, but she's ditched it in favour of an armour-plated shell. Beautiful and protective, clever girl. The same can't be said of me as I look down to see I'm paddling with sharks, swimming and snorkeling with shoals of them, saying hello to rays along the way. On my last day, I see a leaflet entitled Heron Island, Dangers on the Reef. Under the topic sharks and rays, I see the words, they possess the potential to inflict serious injury. Likewise, rays possess one or two venomous serrated barbs on their tail. To be clear, sharks and stingrays have the ability to cause fatalities. I consider myself told and look forward to flying back to my beloved Isle of Wight, where I once saw a porpoise and swam with a seal. Magic.